590 The Fan, Blake Murphy, Alex Forbar, JD Bunkus. Subscribe to the podcast, The Fan Morning Show, wherever you get it. I don't want to say we called it, but we were pretty optimistic about the Toronto Raptors beating their preseason win total over under. I think I actually only had them at 41 wins. The East ended up stronger and deeper than I thought. But we said, hey, you know, they'll be 7 or 8. And if things go well, they could avoid the play-in altogether, maybe. They could get up to 8th in defensive efficiency if things click right. Well, guess what? Your Toronto Raptors hang on using that defense late to beat the Atlanta Hawks 118-108 last night. Elsewhere, the Cleveland Cavaliers, without Jared Allen and Evan Mobley, look like a disaster. They lose to the shell of the Orlando Magic. The combination of those results, being the Raptors have clinched not a play-in spot, a playoff spot. The Raptors will finish no worse than the sixth seed in the Eastern Conference. And this morning, they sit in the fifth seed because the Chicago Bulls also lost last night. Part of the wake and rake, no big deal. The Toronto Raptors control their fate from here in terms of, do you get the five seed? If you win out, the five seed's yours. You got to beat Chicago because Chicago owns the tiebreaker. However, 2, 3, 4 in the East are tied. So five or six seed, you don't know who you're getting. You don't know anything like that. It's time for the Raptors to put what's been a very good regular season in their pocket, I think. And now, hey, rest up for April 16th or April 17th, whichever day of that weekend they'll open the regular season on.
Ooh, that's soon.
It is soon. We got Sunday's the regular season finale. We got Tuesday, Wednesday play-in games, and then we get underway on Saturday with the first round of the playoffs.
No Bucks. As it sits today, the Raptors would be playing Milwaukee in the first round. That's the only nightmare scenario for me. That's the only team that, in my mind, the Raptors do not have a chance at beating. I don't want to be pessimistic.
So I don't. I think ESPN has it as 76ers as of this morning. The way the tiebreakers with that 2, 3, 4 shakeout, because those teams are all maybe ESPN has a mistake in the 3-team tiebreaker scenario there.
No, it's updated as of last night. I guess when I looked at it before I went to bed, the Bucks were still in the 4 seed. But yeah, the tiebreaker must be going to the Bucks. I just had it written down last night where I looked at it that Milwaukee was there. That's the only nightmare to me, though, is the Bucks. And I actually think that if you're the Raptors, when it comes to rest or evaluating this stretch play, you do want to have a little gamesmanship to avoid Milwaukee. That's just me. I don't think
you're going to have the option to do it, because those three teams are all tied and there's only 3 games left.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think you're going to have enough certainty heading into Sunday against the Knicks to know which opponent a loss gets you, which opponent a win gets you.
I'm saying, though, if you do, then you adjust accordingly. Yes. If you know that a win will make you not play Milwaukee in the first round, you load up against the Knicks and you try to win that game. If you know that a loss will make you avoid Milwaukee in the first round, you tank that game into tank heaven. Like, that has to happen for this team. I really do believe that the Raptors can beat any of the top seeds this year. I really do. I don't know if they are deep enough or good enough to make a championship run, but I know that they're good enough and deep enough to win a playoff round against anybody. And I know that, and this is something that we'll probably expand on maybe a little bit tomorrow after the Sixers game and after we actually end up seeing this thing. Or is Sixers a Thursday or is tonight a back-to-back with Sixers a Thursday? I think the Raptors are scarier than Brooklyn. Like, KD just dropped a 55 piece with Kyrie scoring over 30 the other night, and Brooklyn lost. And I also won the wake and rake, no big deal. So that's 2 wins in wake and rake. You've got to figure that we won the wake and rake last night. And it's because of the theory, which is, hey, Brooklyn is not very strong. They're just not a very good team. They're one superstar, one star, and hoping Seth Curry shows up. Like, I don't really know what they are. The Raptors are the scariest non-starting the season or starting the playoffs in a playoff seed, like by a significant margin.
So, and that's not just a gut feel. That is, and I've gone back to these stats a number of times this year because they're important, and they are, I don't know the strength of their predictiveness, but certainly in terms of your confidence level and how they match up and your fear if you're another team. Miami, Boston, Milwaukee, and Philly are all top 10 teams this year by pretty much however you cut it up. Mm-hmm. Here are the league's best teams against top 10 opponents. The Boston Celtics, the Phoenix Suns, the Toronto Raptors. in that order. The Raptors are number 3 in net rating against top 10 opponents. They're 15-11 overall. They have the number 2 defense in basketball against top 10 opponents. Only Boston's better. Yes, there's some of this where Milwaukee probably doesn't have the same care level as other teams over the course of an 82-game season. Miami's dealt with injuries, et cetera, et cetera. The Raptors have dealt with injuries, too. The Raptors have been one of the thinner teams. I think you look at how this coaching staff has historically game-planned for top opponents and especially top individual opponents. You look at how good the Raptors' defense looks when they're on a string together, or even last night when, like, the defense wasn't even on a string. They kept making a lot of mistakes, but down the stretch, they're just everywhere. The effort level is so high that two guys can close out to the same shooter by mistake, and you're fine because someone's got your back. And I think, yeah, the number being the number 2 defense over an entire over 26 games against top 10 teams, that's a third of a season. It's a third of the league, and you're the number 2 defense. That should give you some confidence that you can take a bite out of some of these teams. And Boston is the one that, yeah, they've been even better. They're the best team in basketball since the turn of the calendar. They're the best team, the best defense in the league. Robert Williams is out, though. So Boston is maybe a team you don't want to draw to. But I was on the Raptor show with William Liu yesterday, and we kind of vibe-checked the four top East teams and who you'd most want to face. And it feels weird because they have two very, very, very good players. I think it's the 76ers, and I think we talked about that the other day. And last night, they almost blow a monster lead to the Pacers. They end up winning by 9, but they're outscored by 11 by the Pacers in 9 minutes that Joel Embiid sits. This is a Pacers team that is playing our guy O'Shea Brissett 30 minutes. That's starting Terry Taylor. That is playing Dwayne Washington Jr. 25 minutes off the bench. Like, this is not a full Pacers squad, and the 76ers are sputtering. JD, would you agree that if Milwaukee's a team you want to see least, Philly's probably your preference of those four?
Yeah,
or let's say those three, because Miami falling to 3 or 4 is statistically very unlikely at this point.
Yeah, I said it right after they lost the Heat that was the positive, is that you're not playing the Heat. It's not going to happen. Yeah. It would take some type of a miracle. Philly's been my team all along.
Yeah.
Philly, it's funny because they play the Hawks last night, and my real thought from yesterday outside of Fred, which we'll get to in a second, and the rest and how they treat these games and the way you started the segment, Blake, is the Raptors could be this year's Atlanta Hawks, where you opened up the season and everyone went, what exactly is this team doing? Atlanta's version was actually the opposite, where they decided to get so many scorers and so many guys who handle the ball, and they went, okay, we're going to load up on Bogdanovich and Gallo and with Trae Young, and they went out and had Lou Williams, right? They had Rajon Rondo to start the season. And, of course, that ends up being the flip. But everyone questioned the blueprint and said, we've never really seen something like this in a while have success. The Raptors went the other way, but it was viewed through the lens of defense, which is what happens when you get all 6'9" guys. There's not really a blueprint for this. This is kind of the overemphasizing of what playoff basketball ends up looking like a lot of times, which is teams going small since the Warriors. The Raptors have shocked everybody with the effectiveness of this. And yeah, it's required some of their depth to work out, like Precious Achiuwa being ahead of schedule, and for them to have hit on Boucher in another year where he's played, I would say, above what expectations were for him. Scotty Barnes being the rookie of the year, or at least one of the top 2 candidates for that award this season, being way ahead of schedule where people thought he was going to be. And, of course, Siakam's growth, right? So I just look at the Raptors and say, why can't they be this year's Atlanta, where they make a run but have a ceiling, right? Where we felt that way about Atlanta of, like, they're probably not going to win a championship. They're probably a little too heavily flawed. They're probably missing a little bit to win, to beat an elite team. But if you put them against a 76ers team that has a shaky moment, I don't think the Raps are going to feel afraid of it. I think that they're going to do well here. And just the way the two teams match up, I'm less scared about Boston without Robert Williams. I got to tell you, Blake, just from, I know there's the vaccination stuff, but you just look at the way Siakam had that game against them. It wasn't a coincidence. It's that there was nobody around the rim that could take Siakam away from his area. And when Siakam doesn't have a rim protector around, that's when he cooks. That's when you go, oh, Siakam's going to have a 30-point night tonight, because he's going to get to all of his spots with ease, and there's just nothing you can do but double, and then we know the playmaker he is. So Boston, not as scary without Robert Williams, but you're right. I would say if I had to rank it, definitely not Milwaukee. Boston number two, but more beatable than before. And Philadelphia, I actually feel as though right now them and the Raptors are an even series.
So the Raptors have three games left. They play here against Philadelphia on Thursday. They host the Houston Rockets on a back-to-back Friday, and then they visit the New York Knicks on Sunday. Mm-hmm. We can have preferences between Boston, Milwaukee, and Philly and how that shakes out. The way it looks right now, you won't know. Five or six, you could end up with the same opponent. So the Raptors can control if they win. They can't control much about their opponent. Also because it would require, like, say you end up wanting the 6 seed, it requires Chicago to win too. And I don't know if Chicago's capable of that right now. They're a bit of a disaster.
They're not getting Ball back now. That's the new news, is that they're not getting Lonzo back for the rest of the season, which really hurts them. Really hurts them. That Chicago season really turned on its ear.
Great first half of the season, and then just a disaster since. So, looking at these last three games then, three games in four nights to close out the season. The Raptors are mostly locked in terms of playoff seeding. Nick Nurse says last night about Fred VanVleet, how do you look at this? He's not 100% out there. He's lacing them up and giving everything he's got, and he just doesn't feel great. Nick Nurse was later asked about if clinching changes their approach, and he says, I don't think it changes our mindset that we're going to compete to win. I will have to probably evaluate a little bit who's playing and minutes and all those kind of things, see where we're at health-wise. Probably a little bit of, I would imagine, and then he trailed off, but saying in terms of resting guys. As of right now, Scottie Barnes, Pascal Siakam, and Fred VanVleet are 13, 14, 15 in total minutes played on the season. Because of injuries and stuff and time off, they're no longer right at the very top, which, by the way, it's Mikhail and Miles Bridges as 1-2, which is really funny to me. Two M Bridges that everyone thinks are brothers and aren't related are also 1-2 in minutes. Siakam and VanVleet are headed for some rest, I think, with some certainty. I could see Gary Trent getting some rest with the toe. I don't know if they rest Scottie Barnes because he's got the Rookie of the Year to play for, and every minute he plays here is a minute that he can extend his lead on an Evan Mobley in terms of total impact and the amount you've played, or fight off Cade Cunningham or what have you. Fred's the big one here, though. Like Pascal, you can get rest as a matter of he's had a very heavy season since he got back, and he's been really important. You want him fresh. But Fred's the one who has been injured and has dealt with some ups and downs in his play. Ailish, you had a very close look at Fred's being banged up and limping up and down the court for half a game.
Mm-hmm.
Almost half a game. Where are you guys at in terms of, does Fred play again this season? Because it is three games. That's a long layoff. We're looking at 10 days off then before you play. That's a tough rhythm thing. But also Fred said after the game that part of the reason they pushed and he pushed through this to get these wins is because by avoiding the play-in, you get extra time off.
So Fred sat from February 28th until March 12th. With whatever it is that he has been dealing with recently. And he didn't seem to improve all that much. I don't know what's up with Fred, Blake. You probably have a better idea than literally anybody, but other than people directly in his camp. But it's just a very difficult one to evaluate because he plays the way that he did against Kyle Lowry, and we go, Fred is fine, and Fred is back, and Alvin says he's got the pop back in his legs, and then he has a bad night from a shooting standpoint anyways. I thought his defense was quality yesterday. Like, again, it was another good defensive performance from Fred. And it goes, well, now he's hurt, and now he's banged up. I don't think you're playing him nearly as many minutes. I don't know if it's a complete shutdown scenario and you want a guy to not play or handle the ball or be in a competitive spot leading into a postseason when that's kind of the identity of your team. But I just don't know really what to make of this injury other than rest doesn't seem to be an issue in terms of getting a full recovery here. So how are we quantifying this? But also, why is it that one night he can look like that and then the next night this? It's just there's an oddity to it. With Siakam, that one's obvious to me. You're 100% ramping down his minutes, and you're doing the same thing. Chris Black, a producer here, he pointed out that Siakam's played the most minutes since just after Christmas, December 28th. He's played 1,916 minutes. The next closest player is DeRozan at 1693. That is a massive divide between those players. We discuss all the time how Siakam has the best conditioning arguably in the NBA and that he's a freak athlete in his own sense of like he's a distance runner. But that's something where I'm saying, hey, Pascal, you play, I don't know, a few minutes a night. Maybe you're shut down for the final game of the season entirely. But we're not even getting close to the even. We're getting around 25 minutes a night for you. You get little spot starts here to start halves. These are scrimmages for you. We're making sure that the health of all these guys is paramount.
So in terms of Fred's performance, I'm obviously never been an elite athlete, and so I don't know what it's like obviously. I don't know what it's like to play through injuries like this. It's one too where I would feel differently about it if the shooting was there. But he's been under 30% on threes over March and April, which is very uncharacteristic of him. Like, Fred's such a high floor player that the defense and the spacing threat is supposed to, you know, make sure that you're driving winning still. And 9 assists last night, so it wasn't a complete nothing. But Ailish, you've been injured before and you've played through injuries and stuff like that. Is this just a matter of some nights it's going to feel better than other nights until it's all the way healed? Is it, you know, what is your experience with that kind of thing? Or what do you think Fred might be going through there? Because I don't have a good explanation for why he looks really good some nights, even though it's the same soreness and swelling and stuff like that.
Well, obviously, I don't really know exactly his injury, but speaking from previous experience dealing with injury, it's not only just getting into a rhythm, it's the mental side of it, of like knowing that you're kind of injured and maybe you play a little bit guarded, you play a little bit different. I certainly have been there before. I think that the argument if you should rest Fred or not, to me, is a no-brainer. You know, what JD was saying is tapering down his minutes. Like, I don't think that that has any negative effect on him. Keeping him in the games, though, I think for sure is something you should consider. Letting him sit for 2-3 games and then ramp up all of a sudden to play in, you know, high-intensity playoffs, I don't see that being a fix either. The point that he took a lot of time off and still didn't recover is a bit alarming because, you know, what else can there be to be done? You're not going to get surgery. You're not going to, you know, miraculously heal. So I like the idea of giving him a little bit, giving him some rest, because getting back into it once you've sat is definitely hard on the mental aspect of the game. So I think there's that to consider. And it also matters what the Raptors can do in terms of that plan, as we were saying earlier. Like, if they need to load up on that Knicks game and win to push themselves into a better seeding, then certainly, like, I think he can shoulder that, and he's shown that he can play a huge game when needed. But I would be heavily considering the next two games, at least, just giving him a lot more rest, keeping him in it, keeping his ball touches there, but not, like, you know, sitting him and letting him kind of get out of the mentality of playing.
Since the All-Star break, he's shooting less than 30% from three. His shooting percentage, his true shooting percentage has completely fallen down. A lot of that has to do with, obviously, the free throws and the inability or the lack of the same ability to get to the stripe and get into the paint. But I just, at this point with Fred, I'm asking him, this is a personal question for him, honestly. It's, do you feel as though you have fallen out of a rhythm because of this rest? Mm-hmm. Or do you feel as though your legs are gassed and you're having difficulty with whatever this injury is to have the same lift under your jump shot playing in a lot of games? So do we need you to try to get that lift back over 5 days or get closer to it? Or do you feel like you need to shoot the ball in a game every couple of nights?
Or is there a conditioning aspect too? Like, if you take that much time off, and like, I know that they're elite athletes, but it's different than practicing, right?
Yeah.
You know, you're not giving 1,000% in practice and you're not playing hard minutes against other people. You can definitely get out of a rhythm, but you can also get out of your peak performance levels.
Yeah, I haven't seen him with conditioning issues. I just see the legs, obviously, like, it's just the shooting has dropped off. And so it's like, this is what I'm saying about the frustrating element of this injury, is that I don't see a guy that's struggling to play defense. I see a guy who's still locked in and doing that at an extremely high level, who's still turning guys over and still digging in great. It's just that, is he just having a bad, like, I'm sure he's hurt. I'm not questioning whether he's hurt or whether he's banged up. But I do question sometimes where you go, okay, well, you just had a good shooting night. Now you're having a bad shooting night. You've had a bit of a bad shooting stretch. Is this something that we're bringing up whenever you play poorly, and then we're completely ignoring when you play well? How much of it is psychosomatic or the way that we're talking to the media about this. Like, there's just some elements here that are very, very shaky. And so when we're asking, like, what do? We rest him or not? I think, yeah, because that's the natural inclination of the NBA. It's just that it's hard to get a full read for me. This isn't as obvious as for me with the Siakam thing where the guy's playing great and you go,
right.
Yeah, just make sure he doesn't get hurt.
Mm-hmm. Another Raptor with some play status question marks over these last couple games, and a guy I would certainly lean toward get him in there to get some of his rhythm back, is OG Anunoby, who's still dealing with a thigh bruise. This will be the fourth consecutive season that OG Anunoby has missed pretty significant time for the Raptors. Pivoting to a player who profiles similarly in terms of bad luck with another Toronto team, it's time for something to chew on, brought to you by Great Canadian Meats.
Yum, yum, yum.
Nate Pearson has mono.
Unreal.
This dude
not a yum 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 moment.
Cannot
yuck, yuck, yuck.
Catch a break. Yeah, do not share your Great Canadian Meats with Nate Pearson. Don't
stay away.
Him. No smooching with the boys.
No more smooching with the fellas for Nate Pearson for now.
I saw someone tweet yesterday that it's extra sad because you know that none of his teammates were smooching him because no one else has mono. The fellas, poor guys. No, Nate Pearson has mono. It sounds like he's going to open the season on the injured list. And then I would imagine hits AAA for like a extended rehab / we have you in the minors, but it's not an option kind of thing. Something to chew on here. This is a bad sign. Or JD, I think, put in our planning doc, William the Conqueror. I'm going to kick it to JD to make the case that Nate Pearson is old Billy Conquer.
Well, the way that I frame that is just simply when he landed, he stepped off the boat. The famous story goes is that he slipped and that was taken as a horrific omen, right? They go, old Bill the Conqueror, he fell down. It's a bad omen. Everybody thinks he's cursed. But you know what? He's the only guy. He's Conquer England, right? So maybe it works out for Nate Pearson. Maybe this is what he needs. Maybe this is not a curse. But it sure feels like a curse right now. I'm on the boat behind the Conqueror going, we should turn the ship around because I just do not. I hate the way that this is starting. Mono? Like, have you guys ever known anybody with mono? Have you ever had mono?
Like, in high school, people had mono.
Yeah,
I never
for
had
sure.
mono. But, like, this is not a thing that happens. Like, it was very strange to see that being the diagnosis. Like, COVID would have made more sense, obviously.
But mono affects people in different ways in terms of timeline of recovery. It's a fatigue thing that ends up hitting you, right? You can have, like, now we all talk about long COVID of all of a sudden people have the weird fatigue times, right? Okay, that's mono, is that you can end up having someone who doesn't recover properly for months. Like, I don't know how that affects somebody in his shoes, a pitcher who throws really hard. It doesn't feel good. But either way, the Blue Jays have already said he's going to be out a significant amount of time, that he's going to miss real time. And now, a guy who was already a story coming into the season, right, who already was going to have a weird role, has to step back into a big league club and find himself, and potentially is going to be an even bigger story with depending on where this team is at. Like, none of this feels good. I kind of wanted Nate Pearson to just have a normal spring, show up with the Blue Jays with a defined role, step into the season with that role, get some momentum building, and find himself. And I do think that this is with anybody. That if we're looking at Nate Pearson going, this guy can't catch a break, you know who else is probably doing that? Nate Pearson. He's probably thinking, I can't catch a break. And if you start to get into the woe is me mentality, that sort of leads you down the path of, well, wait, wasn't the thing with him a little bit between the ears last season? We all know that he's got the right stuff. Does he have the composure of the Manoah? Does he have the demeanor of a Manoah? And if I'm him, this isn't helping any of that. This is tough. Now you're in isolation, you're on your own, you're fatigued. Guess what you have to do when you're in isolation and you're fatigued? You overthink things. You're in your head. So this is really awful for Nate Pearson. I feel for the kid. I wish that he could just get out there and pitch. And when I read that yesterday, I hate to admit the feeling I had, which is I just went, huh, this is just never going to be a thing. And that we all knew that not every one of the Jays prospects was going to hit, but it's just, this is starting to feel like, man, how long can you wait for the 26-year-old arm?
Yeah. We need, I definitely hope it ends with a Nate the Conqueror situation. We got to find him an old Matilda Flanders, heal him up, turn things around. I don't know, because you're right. At this point, and I felt this way a little bit coming into the year when they added an extra starter and Stripling's a lock for the long man, swing man role and stuff like that. Is it doesn't feel like it feels like their approach with building this roster, both rotation and bullpen, has been anything you get from Nate Pearson at this point is gravy. It sucks that he's been a top prospect and he has all this potential and it just hasn't come around yet. But look at how they built the rotation. Like, Pearson's seventh on the depth chart as far as starters or filling goes. They're talking about maybe a bulk role because they just need to get his innings up at this point after so many shortened seasons. I think that's the only way to approach it moving forward. So that's something that you want.
But that's the other thing. That's the other thing, Blake, is like they're trying to get this kid innings.
Yeah.
Like, they're trying to build up his arm.
You know what causes further injury? Not pitching much for a really long time and then throwing 104 miles an hour, whatever it is he lights the radar gun up at these days. So that's something to chew on for the Jays. That's something to chew on for Nate Pearson, certainly. Hopefully he's not chewing on it too much while he's isolated. We're going to take a break. When we come back, someone who is recovering way faster than we may have thought from injury, Tiger Woods. We're going to talk to David Faraday, former PGA Tour golfer, current NBC and Golf Channel analyst, about Tiger's potential return this weekend. That's next. The Fan Morning Show. Sports at 590, The Fan.
Everything Raptors before and after the games. The Raptor Show with Will Liu. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
JD Blake and Amos. I gotta say that, and because I guess I am a broadcaster, I think I'm the least broadcaster that lines up with that song, like that music, like my
1,000%.
Yeah, yeah. It's hard for me. Vic keeps playing it, and I actually feel like he's sewering me because I'm not classy. I'm not dignified. You know, I don't bring an air of tradition with me. I love that song, but when he forces me to speak over top of it, I actually resent him for it. No one would think that about our next guest. He fits perfectly. It's David Faraday, former PGA Tour golfer, current NBC and Golf Channel analyst, of course, the host of The Faraday Show. David Faraday, thanks for joining us again, man.
No, it's a pleasure. Good morning.
Good morning, good morning. So, not much to talk about this year. No major stories, just kind of a ho-hum year. Not a lot of people excited. Nothing really in the news cycle. I'm just going to start with this. How did this happen? What do you know about his rehab recovery? Because everyone that we've spoken to seems to be completely in the dark, seems to be completely surprised by this. And yet Tiger Woods is just the athlete where we've been conditioned not to be surprised. It looks like he's going to play. But what are people around the golf world discussing when it comes to just the recovery itself?
Well, you know, he's always played his cards so close to his chest. He does everything like that privately. But, you know, when I saw him at the PNC at the father-son last year, I said, he's playing the Masters. You know, there's no reason why he wouldn't. Also, he showed up in Augusta early. There's no other reason to go to Augusta, believe me, unless you're going to play in the Masters.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not exactly like you go around the Masters, around Augusta, and it's just like a million things to take in and do, right? Okay, so he's there.
No.
He looks like he's going to play. I guess you would have read the tea leaves better than a lot of us. But the read on Tiger has always been, too, that, hey, okay, this guy's never going to be ceremonial at golf tournaments. But is it the worst thing if he is for golf? Like, if he shows up here and the expectation is, well, he's Tiger Woods, but he doesn't look like Tiger Woods, but he just makes the cut. And, yeah, that's the way that this weekend ends up feeling. Is that a bad thing for golf if that's what we get from Tiger moving forward?
I don't think so. You know, I think anytime you see him, especially after this, you know, it's kind of a treat. I mean, and I don't think he's going to play unless he thinks he can win. I mean, that's for sure. And it would not surprise me in the slightest if he gets into contention.
So you mentioned thinking that he might win. He was asked yesterday if, you know, he potentially could win the Masters, and he said, I think so. And as confident as that is, what do you think of how he looks so far? You know, he's had a couple rounds and everyone's got their eyes on him, as you saw with like a massive crowds following him. How is he actually looking compared to a Tiger in the past prepping for the Masters?
He's rehabbed so thoroughly, and he does everything like that, you know, whether it's preparation for a tournament or preparing his body. He looks like a runner. He looks like a boxer. He looks like a UFC fighter. He's just in amazing shape, you know. So people that are saying, oh, well, he won't be able to walk the golf course, he's walking, you know. I mean, he looks like he could run the golf course.
Yeah, he looks like he's in phenomenal shape, and yeah, the swing looks great. People have said this already, but it's not like it was with the back injury where he's had to make real adjustments to his swing or to his game. But yeah, the foot is the thing, right? It's that he's discussed that openly, is that his foot has had some issues, that it hasn't felt completely right. And I wonder if you can tell us what it's like, though, to walk that course for 4 days when there is something that isn't fully right with your lower body.
Well, you know, first of all, this is a guy who's won a U.S. Open with a broken leg.
So, it's 46 now, though.
It's a 46-year-old foot then. it's as long as it's on the end of his leg, I think, you know, he'll be able to walk this golf course. It is hilly, he's just in phenomenal shape, and I don't think that foot's going to bother him. As I said, he plays his cards so close to his chest, you never know, but I don't think he'll play unless he thinks he can win. And if he thinks he can win, he can win.
Yeah, that's the thing that has everybody so excited, right, is that this is not someone who is a just-show-up guy. Like, that's why I asked you the ceremonial question, because I go, maybe we just need to recalibrate our expectations, and I think that he'll get this 1 year of, like, a grace period in terms of the way people expect him to be there. But it's just, I cannot, like right now, in the gambling world, he's plus money to make the cut or to miss the cut. And I'm going, or make the cut, sorry. And I'm thinking, there's just no way. I feel like if he's playing outside of a withdrawal, he's going to be making the cut. He's going to be there Saturday, Sunday.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's just the sort of golf course that suits him. You know, it fits his eye. Everything about this week. And the only mistakes that I've ever made about, you know, in the 25 years that I've been covering him is when I've underestimated him. That's been the only times I've made mistakes on him, you know. So, don't be surprised to see him in the mix-up.
I don't think I can be anymore, honestly, after this. After
me too.
After what we've gone through, like, it was just a couple months ago where he did that interview with Golf Digest, and it kind of sounded like a semi-retirement. And I actually did a show where I think I talked about how it was the first moment, even after the crash, where it had dawned on me that we were never really going to get Tiger Woods again. And now I just feel like he played everybody, and that it was, hey, don't, oh, shucks, I'm just old Tiger Woods, and I don't know if I'll ever be competitive. I already climbed my Everest, was the way that he put the last Masters win. And so you go, okay, he's done. He's not going to try to climb the mountain again. He's not going to try to be there competitively all the time again. And yet, here he is today. We're speaking to David Faraday, former PGA golfer, again, current NBC and Golf Channel analyst, host of the excellent Faraday. What's your barometer for, hey, this is what I want to see from Tiger Woods? Because again, like, we're not going to be surprised by anything, but what's the main area this weekend where you want to see what Tiger Woods can do? It's like, what is the one thing you care about most?
If I were to pick one thing, do you mean one aspect of his game?
Of his game. Yeah, one aspect of his game.
Yeah. Well, if he drives the ball well, I think he'll play well. And Yeah, that's the key at Augusta, really. You know, is driving the ball well and putting. It's such a difficult golf course in places, although they just had torrential rain down there. I'm a little way up the road here in Columbia, North Carolina, and it's going to be wet. It's going to play long, and the golf course, the longer it plays, the easier it is for these guys because the ball hits and stops. So I think it'll suit them. It's going to be damp, and I think that'll suit his game.
I wonder your opinion on Tiger's personal competitive nature when it comes to his legacy versus Phil Mickelson, knowing that Phil recently won at 50 and Tiger is now 46. Do you think any of that drives a little bit extra with his comeback to continue to be the top story between those two?
Oh yeah, I think so. He's going to play until he's 50 or beyond, I would say. I mean, I don't think you'll see him on the PGA Tour Champions, but I mean, he'll continue to play, you know, the PGA Tour for as long as he can. And you know, like I said, I mean, I just expect him to win again.
Yeah, I do too. Again, it's Tiger Woods. I don't really know how you couldn't at this point. But, yeah, the Phil stuff to me is actually pretty fascinating with the win at 50 because I just feel like, yeah, he is the kind of guy where he needs just a little something to get the motivation back. And maybe seeing Phil win, he thought, I'm better than Phil. If I get right, that gives me a four-year window where I can still win this thing. I wouldn't even put it past him where he plots it out in a way where he's just slightly older than Phil and then he gets another win, you know, like that he wants that so badly.
Yeah. So those records that he has are amazing. You know, there's so many of them. The cut streak, the weeks at number one, just incredible.
Again, we should tell you that David Faraday is coming to Canada. The Faraday Classic is a special charity golf event happening in Ottawa on June 6th and then here in Toronto on June 7th, back-to-back. Among the guests, pretty loaded, Curtis Joseph, Emmitt Smith, Terry Bradshaw, I think people have heard of those people. Tickets are limited, obviously. You want more information on how to purchase them, you go to FaradayOffTour.com/classic. Again, that's FaradayOffTour.com/classic. My one thing in the Tiger, and this is something we've done every single time Tiger shows up at these events since Tiger hasn't been young, winning every single tournament Tiger. It's, hey, what does this mean for the rest of golf? What does this do to the rest of golf? And if I'm some of these guys in the field, I'm not looking at this. Like, I obviously want Tiger Woods there. There's more attention. There's more eyeballs. But there has just been basically no storyline nationally outside of Tiger. Rightfully so. It's the sports story of the year. You can lock it down if he's even there on Saturday. But how do you feel just about that element of things where guys are ramping up for the biggest event of the year and we have golf as healthy as it's been from a top-tier player standpoint, and it's kind of another year where we don't learn about anybody else's story heading into this thing. It is just primarily dominated with Tiger Tracker.
Yeah, it is. I mean, he just manages to pull that rabbit out of his, out of a hat. Boy, that was close.
No, it's okay. You can say that. You can do what you want. You're David Faraday.
Yeah. He just manages to pull the rabbit out of the hat so often. And, I mean, you're right. It sort of becomes, you expect it. You really do.
So JD mentions that a lot of the media coverage, at least, has obviously been on Tiger Woods, understandably. But if we look at the Masters in general, it does feel like the field is a lot more wide open than usual. And I guess coming on Sunday, looking into this week, what's the biggest storyline or player to watch in your eyes that isn't the Tiger Woods story?
I really like Dustin Johnson. He's due to play well. You know, he dropped outside the top 10 in the world, which will really piss him off. He's the kind of player, you know, that should win this tournament. I mean, he drives the ball so incredibly far and putts beautifully on fast greens. So I like Dustin Johnson this week. And as an outsider, I like the Canadian, Corey Connors.
Yeah. Love that.
What do you like about Corey Connors here?
I love Corey's game, you know, and the way he thinks. You know, he's a level-headed kid. He's got a great attitude, drives the ball a long way, and is a terrific putter as well. So, you know, he's just the sort of player that could do well at Augusta.
Again, if you want to see our next guest, you can, because he'll be here in the country. Ottawa, June 6th, Toronto, June 7th. Loaded slate of guests, again, including Curtis Joseph, Emma Smith, and Terry Bradshaw. And if you want those tickets, you visit Faherty Offtour.com/classic. David, as always, thank you for your time, and enjoy this weekend.
It's a pleasure. Anytime, guys. Thanks a lot.
Take care. David Faherty. So this is, like, again, we're all enamored by Tiger Woods, and we're all rooting, I think, for Tiger Woods at this point, right? Because when you weren't rooting for Tiger, like I wasn't, it was because he was such a front runner and he was the favorite. And so a lot of sports fans don't root for the favorite. Some people do, some people don't, but I've always cheered for the underdog. Now he's that. Like, now Tiger Woods, truly, you have it all from the fan standpoint. I don't know who right now is going, I don't want to see Tiger Woods on Saturday. Like, there's just no way. I don't see the person that's not a direct family member of one of the other golfers in this tournament that's not saying, oh, you know what, I wouldn't mind if next year on the A-list, A-list is bringing up Tiger's menu again. You know, like, this is clearly everyone is into Tiger Woods. But he's coming in here, and he's sort of been the, I don't want to say, but he's been like golf dad to a lot of these guys, right? We know about his relationship specifically with Justin Thomas, but there's this, hey, we love Tiger. Tiger, it's so great to have you here. We love Tiger. We love Tiger. We love Tiger. And I've been annoyed at times because golfers are now so rich. There's so much money to be made that the competitiveness doesn't feel as serious as maybe it once did. There doesn't seem to be the edges between guys. And then when the one time it was kind of this overplayed thing between, you know, like the DeChambeau thing and Koepka, where it was just, it became comical and oversized and corny. But I do wonder if the field a little bit this time around, not maybe this time because Tiger's recovery has been so miraculous and people are probably so happy to see him, but there's got to be at least a bit of an edge for certain guys where they go, you know, I want attention. I have an ego. This is the event that matters more than any other by far. Some it'll work out for, but I want to know, if we're doing that Netflix series, I want to know who's a little annoyed and who wanted a little bit more camera time and an extra article, a little bit more shine, and goes, man, this is another time where Tiger is coming back and stealing things and doing it in the most perfectly calculated media way that Tiger did it, which is like he's dominated the cycle from showing up at Augusta to doing the 50-50 to now the probably I'm going to play. Like, the way he's doled this out has been a masterclass. And I actually hope that there are some guys there that are kind of pissed off by it and don't want to just revere him. They want to go there and dominate the course.
So I actually wanted to ask you guys the inverse of that and how you would feel if you're Lewis Oosthuizen or Joaquin Niemann, who those are both top 20 guys. They're going to tee off with Tiger Woods at 10:34 tomorrow morning Eastern time. And then they're going to tee off with him again 1:41 on Friday in the afternoon. Are you... Like, obviously, that's going to be a little bit distracting. You're going to have all the cameras. You're going to have the biggest crowds for each hole and things like that. But you're not a household name, and you're a top 20, top 15 guy. Is that an opportunity for you? Like, do you get a little extra fired up?
Louis, like, a pretty big name, and he's – but I would say that sure, he's the biggest choker on tour. And so, like, it's to be paired with Tiger in this way. I'm going, oh, man, I get seen more, I'm more visible, but the problem is that it's almost like one of those things where standing next to Tiger, you're invisible, right? Like, nobody cares what you're doing. Nobody cares what you, like, you're going to have more camera time, but what's the value of this camera time, right? Like, especially early on in the tournament where Louis, no one really cares what you do the first 2 days, buddy. Like, we all care what you do on Sunday now. Like, how are you closing? Because, again, the choking that he's had at major tournaments. So,
but do you not think that's a good test or a good window into him then? Because there is the added element of pressure. If you're Oosthuizen, do you just not – you don't feel that because you're trying to convince yourself you're above the Tiger noise and you're focused on Sunday?
I think all guys want to be able to say that, but the sport is so mental that I don't feel as though there's like an advantage in having put an extra element of the mental stuff on you. Like, I don't see it as one where you go, well, now you can do this, and now it's like you're already at the Masters. Like, if you win this thing, it's already the proving of everything, right? And so to stack the deck and having to be with Tiger Woods, I'm sure there are some people, Blake, that relish extra spotlight in terms of, boy, this is exciting. But I still think that that's a distraction from what you need to do, which is hit good golf shots. And so I just, I maybe it's just me. Maybe that, like, we're peering into the windows of my soul, because this is the question that only I can ask or answer. But to me, it's like, I don't want any extra or added challenge or any extra added anything heading into Augusta. I just want to be thinking about my game, the course, and any little piece, even if it's a sliver, where you're spending time thinking about Tiger Woods and the crowds that are going to be following Tiger Woods and the extra attention that's going to be coming with Tiger Woods. I have a tough time seeing how that's a positive, unless it's a hindsight thing where you do end up winning and you go, well, now it's good because people saw me do it, and everybody remembers it differently because it was paired with Tiger.
I think in any other sport, possibly this would have more of an influence. I think in golf, you know, it's such a tough mental game. You can only control yourself. Like, you can only go in there and play your best game. I wonder, I see your logic behind it, Blake, in asking that question. And I've never played golf at a competitive level, but I've played, you know, every summer myself. And I think it is just so much about you being on your game and you being in the best mental state that you can. There's already so much pressure with the Masters, and there's already so much attention that goes into it. It will be interesting to see how those guys, you know, respond, because I'm sure the media will ask this question: what's it like to play alongside Tiger? What's it like for his comeback? And maybe that will be motivating, and maybe that will be like, it's awesome to play alongside him. I'm in awe. You know, I'm actually distracted at watching what Tiger does, and being alongside him is one of the greatest comeback stories of all time. I think that the main underlying thing is, I'm sure everybody or a majority of people grew up or have played with Tiger, and they feel a competitive drive against him because he's the best. You know, everybody knows Tiger Woods. Everybody loves the game of golf, and a lot of people would attribute that to him. So maybe the young guys see this as an exciting thing that he's back. Maybe the old guys see it as like, well, you know, I got to prove myself over him. Either way, yeah, fan, I'm just, you know, I've grown up watching Tiger Woods, so it's really exciting to see it.
Yeah, and for me, as I'm a golf novice, I'm not too deep into it, but Oosthuizen becomes one of the most fascinating guys on the weekend for me, as a guy who, you know, the last three majors finished top three but couldn't get it done, and he hasn't had a lot of success at the Masters until you go back to like 2012. So yeah, I mean, it's nice to just get an extra eyeball on him as well. But it'll be interesting to hear at least what people like David think about, hey, is there a Tiger rub? Is there a Tiger drain? How that all plays out.
Well, again, it's golf. And so it's all about being classy, and everybody loves everybody again because the money. Mm-hmm. But and it's different, again, that there's an element of especially rooting for Tiger because he is getting healthy from a horrific car crash. This isn't like the self-inflicted stuff with the back where we're getting weird stories about what he's doing with, you know, military training drills, right? This isn't that. This is a totally different thing. So, but even still, I kind of wonder, it's another Tiger Woods comeback story. And if there is a little bit of fatigue for some of the guys on tour, even if it isn't like, again, no one's not saying, oh man, I wish Tiger wasn't here. But I do wonder if there are some guys that are going, man, okay, like, let me take the reins. Like, I want to be the face of Augusta. I don't know who that guy is, because those guys don't really make themselves clear. I guess it would be sort of Koepka. Koepka would be the only one that kind of seems to have that edge. But yeah, Tiger fatigue a little bit within the group. It won't be here because it's his first comeback. But moving forward, what does this look like when Tiger's not playing on tour, and then he wants to just come back and play the odd major and steal the spotlight from guys? Will it stay like he's golf dad to everyone, where he's just revered by everyone? Or will guys start to become a little bit more, I don't know, chippy? How about that?